One of the iconic radio shows of the golden age of radio was Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater Players of the Air with The War of the Worlds, first broadcast October 30th, 1938. What scared people so much was that it seemed so realistic the way that they did it. And that's fascinating enough. But for today, we have a great opportunity to get a much closer look at what happened and what was a part of all that, because a longtime friend of mine, we go back to high school, told me recently, or reminded me recently, that her dad was involved with Orson Welles and with the War of the Worlds. And I said, well, then we need to talk about that. That's just awesome. Her dad was my first college theater director, but the summer before I started college, he played my father in a musical. The ties to this are pretty close. So, Terry Heplin, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your dad, Bert, and his incredible connection to one of the most iconic radio shows of all time.
Oh, well, it's good to be here. Thank you for asking me to do this. I'm sorry I can't be, you know, make a classroom appearance and take questions and everything. So afterward, if you want and you want the students to pose some questions and you want to get my responses, I'll be very glad to come back and answer those questions.
Excellent.
I know Q&A is always an important part of everything.
How did your dad get involved? I realized that when I first met you and your dad and your mom, y'all were living in Daytona Beach the same as I was, but you hadn't always lived there, and your father and your mother certainly hadn't always lived in Florida.
No. As a matter of fact, I ended up in Daytona Beach because my father was going to be Stetson University's public relations director. As it turned out, he ended up teaching at Daytona Beach Community College. Decided he'd had enough of public relations and he wanted out of it. And so when he finished his master's at the University of Florida, this teaching position came open. And that's how we ended up in Daytona Beach. But
Okay. Originally,
my father was very, very well connected in New York City. He was editor-in-chief advertising department of Collier's Magazine. And Collier's was a huge, huge magazine back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, I think all the way up until early 70s when it finally folded. And my mother was an opera singer with the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And they met after World War II in New York City. And I'm a very typical baby boomer. They got married in New York City, moved to the suburbs in New Jersey, and yeah. But it was really Daddy's connection with so many people in the advertising industry, the magazine, the entertainment industry in New York City, Broadway, as well as Madison Avenue. They're very interconnected. They're still very interconnected today. He also was able to work relationships with actors and producers and directors and other editors of other magazines, and how he got involved with Orson Welles was through the advertising and the PR connection.
That's the reason that they were in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did he, because of his public relations background, is that how he ended up making the acquaintance of Orson Welles?
Yes, it was all public relations. Orson Welles was writing a script. Daddy had movie connections in the entertainment industry out in Los Angeles as well.
Her dad's cousin was the famous actor Van Heflin.
He was a very connected person. As a matter of fact, I have a cousin who keeps telling me I need to write all this down. I really do. An amazing, amazing man. But he had so many different connections. He knew who to call. He knew who to get in touch with. And Orson Welles had this idea of working the script of War of the Worlds. It was going to be it was a Halloween show. I mean, there was, you know, nothing malicious about it.
Right.
There was nothing, you know, horrible was supposed to happen. It was a Halloween show. You know, I think there's a quote that Orson Welles, I remember Daddy telling me something about, oh yeah, it was like everybody running around in sheets, you know, happy Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't quite turn out that way.
No.
Orson Welles had gotten in contact with several people in the public relations industry, and Daddy had connections through many, many circles within New York City with public relations. So even Collier's Magazine was one of the sponsors of the radio show because there were no commercials in the show, which they wanted all the sponsors at the beginning. Right. There were a couple of little interruptions within the show, but not what we would consider a commercial break like what we have today.
Right.
All right. And there were only three major networks, and this was coming out of CBS. So they were buying all the time and working with the script. And so Daddy was working with the script as well. He was not one of the actors on air, but he was there during the production of it that particular night.
Wow.
And I believe it was broadcast at 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be, you know, prime time.
Right.
That's when everybody, in 1938, we didn't have television.
Right.
Yes, they would go see shows or they'd go see movies, but people were at home. And so they would be in front of their radio and they're listening to like Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy, and all these entertainers. A lot of those shows, they really honestly did not expect to have that much of a listenership. They were out there promoting it, and part of Daddy's job was to promote and everything. But they were on at the same time as Charlie McCarthy. I believe he was over on NBC. And so they, you know, Charlie McCarthy at that time was kind of hard to go up against.
Right.
All right.
Right.
So that was competition. But what happened is after Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy went off the air, the ventriloquist, they switched over to CBS and came in after the show had already started.
Right.
So they missed the disclaimer that
right.
this was a dramatic production.
And they didn't give another disclaimer until 42 minutes into the show.
42 minutes in. And it was a very short disclaimer.
Right.
Okay. It was easily missed. A lot of people didn't hear it. They didn't pay any attention to it. Okay? And a lot of that was because of the way the radio took on that news format. It was a news show. And I believe the narrator or the radio broadcaster, if I'm remembering correctly, he even went back and was listening to the reporter who reported on the Hindenburg
mm-hmm.
and listened to the way that story unfolded. And if you've, I know you've heard that Hindenburg radio broadcast.
Oh, yeah.
It is heart-wrenching. It is terrifying. Okay? And so he practiced that. And that's how it was going to come across on the CBS show that particular night. But, they had very little teeny tiny breaks.
I think what makes it such an incredible and iconic show is that people reacted so strongly. And Orson Welles was secretly delighted because he was demonstrating the power of radio that millions mm-hmm. of people were listening mm-hmm. that evening and had some sort mm-hmm. of reaction.
I think there was a number there, if I remember Daddy talking about it. But, you know, here's the funny thing. Because things turned so dramatically with the audience, my father never really liked to talk about the show because he was there when the police came in, when other reporters came in. I mean, the studio all of a sudden started getting these phone calls and people were coming in to see if this was real. And, they couldn't get the word out fast enough. They didn't stop the broadcast at all. They didn't stop it to say, this is a dramatic reading. This is not real. This is a Halloween show. They didn't do that. The president of CBS would not stop the broadcast. So Daddy always kind of felt, this could have been averted, some of this panic. You know, and I mean, there were literally people who were dying. This was the thing that got him.
New Jersey, of course, is the location where the Martians have originally landed in the play.
Right.
And so they were particularly horrified and scared and jumped in their cars, grabbed their kids and their wife and fled.
People were flying off the roads. There were traffic accidents. They had absolute panic. You want to talk about disinformation. This is probably one of the best examples of disinformation and the audience's reaction to it. Because at that time, and Dave, you know this, at that time, broadcasting was the way to get the news out. It was never questioned that this was not real. It was, nobody came on and said this was, just a story. And so it was like, this has got to be true. If it's on the air, it's true. It's like if it's in the newspaper, it's true. There was no questioning as to what was going on. And people panicked. They literally panicked. Now, according to what Dad said later, because we had a few talks about it, he said later on, they tried to do some follow-up, you know, statistics, that really the panic was not as widespread as they thought. But he also said it's very possible that the networks were trying to downplay.
Yeah.
Some of it, just to keep them from any kind of lawsuits.
Because
CBS and Orson Welles and everybody who was involved, all the PR, all the actors, nobody was ever held accountable for this.
Right.
Nobody.
Now, the only thing that came out of it is that the rules were changed for broadcast that you had to have IDs on a regular basis during an hour, and that you had also had to identify the type of show that it was and who your sponsors were. And,
right.
And that all came out of that. So,
Well, that didn't exist.
Right. You know, this is still the Wild West. You know, they're still making up rules as they go along because they didn't think about, oh my gosh, we're going to have a network show that's going to garner this sort of reaction. So,
and I don't think there's been a network show since then.
No,
because of those rule changes.
Right, exactly.
It's
so they were
really
successful. Yeah. Well,
what was really interesting is Daddy mentioned it at one point. Some of the phone calls and the people that they were getting, you know, not the fact that they were Martians landing in New Jersey, but that they were German submarines off the coast of New York and they were going to, you know, the Germans were going to be invading because of what was going on in Europe. That was a whole nother thing.
Dr. Terry Heflin, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Oh, you're so welcome.
That's one of the reasons that it's considered such an iconic show, and I'm delighted that you mentioned it when we were having a conversation completely unrelated to that, and I'm really thrilled that you shared that with us, and again, writing a book about your dad would be a pretty terrific idea.
Yeah, my cousin keeps saying you got to write this down. You've got to write all this down.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, maybe we'll just start doing kind of a little oral history, and every time you think of a story about your dad, you call me up and we'll record it, and we'll just make a series of those, and then eventually we can turn that into something print.
There you go. I'm all for it.
Okay.
All for it.
We've been talking to my friend Dr. Terry Heflin about her dad, Bert Heflin, who on the fateful night of October 30th, 1983, was there in the studio with one of his clients, Orson Welles, as the War of the Worlds stunned a nation. For WTBF, I'm Doc Kirby.